A day to be thankful, even in Paris, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Almost 2 weeks after the Paris attacks, the city is still reeling. So for Americans who call Paris home, this is not your usual Thanksgiving.
This makes me feel more thankful for what I've been given in life. It gives you a kick of awareness and the things that we take for granted a little bit less.
Americans in Paris, we'll check in with some of them on this holiday. Then we turn things around and find out what Thanksgiving tastes like for Afghan Americans here.
There's a little bit of hot spice to it.
Yeah, Louisiana style.
Louisiana style. Yeah. Louisiana Afghani style. Yeah.
Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Hoping you're having a happy holiday if you have the day off. We've got a lot on the program today to tell you about, but we begin with reverberations from Syria and how world leaders are trying to figure out an end to the violence. France and Russia have both suffered from ISIS violence recently. France with the attacks on Paris, Russia with the bombing of an airliner over Egypt 2 weeks before that. So today, French President François Hollande traveled to Moscow to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin and discuss a possible alliance. I asked reporter Charles Maines in Moscow what kind of pitch Hollande is making.
He doesn't have to make much of a pitch, frankly. Mr. Putin's been saying the same thing for the last couple of weeks. And the Russians' interest in this is a bit different than Mr. Hollande's. Now, of course, we remember after the Paris attacks, the Russians ruled the bombing of this airplane that was brought down over the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt a terrorist attack, and the implication being this was also the work of ISIS. After that, Putin really went forward saying, you know, we should all join together in this grand coalition. Now, of course, this incident over the skies of the Turkish-Syrian border with the Russian plane that was brought down by Turkey, a NATO member, certainly complicates that goal because it suddenly makes this coalition much more remote.
Well, especially the Russian response to that downing of that jet seems to be toughening up.
That's right. All through today, we've heard sort of continued, you know, expressions of anger from the Russians, starting with Putin. Today, at just a ceremony at the Kremlin that really had nothing to do with Turkey, he went out of his way to talk once again about how this was a stab in the back, in his words. He was saying he was angry about the fact he hadn't received any apology from the Turkish leadership. And we found out later that President Erdogan of Turkey said he wasn't planning to give one. Now, the Russians also announced one other key thing today. They said that they are planning sanctions against Turkey. I think the only key question is whether it will include energy, because the Russians provide 60% of Turkey's energy imports. But of course, that, you know, risks harming the Russian economy along with the Turkish economy.
Hmm. Well, François Hollande wants Bashar al-Assad out. Like the United States, Putin would like Assad to stay. How can they agree on any goal other than killing ISIS members?
Well, that's the big question, and that's the problem, where the Russians are trying to just say, trying to widen this issue, just say, let's take on ISIS and kind of worry about the rest. But at the same time, I think, you know, you hear from sort of back channels that the Russians are willing to kind of negotiate on that front, and maybe there's a sort of more sort of negotiated exit for Assad rather than his immediate removal. So they may be willing to compromise on that. But I think for now, their goal is just to widen this in some way and put some kind of coalition in place.
Before leaving for Moscow, Hollande took the time to say today that there would be no letting up in sanctions against Russia over its aggression in Ukraine last year. Is that something Russia might be looking for?
Well, I think it's something they may be looking for down the line. The Russians tend not to operate so directly as to say, you know, let's do a quid pro quo where you take away sanctions and we'll work with you on ISIS and Syria. On the other hand, I think there's a sense that, you know, if they are working together over time, there comes a question where you say, well, if we're working on the same team, why are you punishing us over Ukraine and these other issues? Why are these sanctions in place? So I can see there's something that loosens the grip of sanctions over Russia, particularly from the Europeans, less so from the Americans.
Our friend Charles Maines in Moscow, thank you for your time today, Charles.
Thank you.
With all the unease radiating out from the Middle East these days, it might not be quite as easy this Thanksgiving to put the rest of the world aside and just focus on family and friends. And it'll be all but impossible this year for American expats in Paris. This most American of holidays is usually a day when expats around the world cast their eyes homeward. But for some Americans in Paris this year, Thanksgiving will be all about France. Reporter Adeline Cyr caught up with two of them at a crowded cafe in the 11th arrondissement.
Jessica Walker and Andy McClure are good friends who both live in the area that was hit on Friday the 13th. Walker is a consultant who grew up in Boston and has been calling Paris home for 11 years. She was playing tennis on the other side of town that fateful night, so she found out about the attacks when she spoke to her relatives back in Boston. They were watching the news on CNN.
But if there's a European part of me?
I also think that there's a little bit of...
McClure is from Raleigh, North Carolina, and is an architect. He's resided in Paris for 8 years. Like many Parisians, he knows dozens of people who were affected by the attacks. McClure was home in the 10th district that night, just blocks away from Le Carillon Bar and Le Petit Cambodge restaurant, where 15 people were shot dead. He did not hear the shots being fired, but he did hear sirens all night long. This attack, he says, really hit the heart of his community.
Paris is it's a provincial place. It's not really a city in the classic sense. It's a neighborhood. And this is my neighborhood. I mean, this is like my blood. You know, this is where I go. I pass the Carillon, the Petit Cambodge, probably between 4 and 6 times a day.
McClure was a regular at the restaurants that were hit, but he says he hasn't felt particularly frightened since the attacks.
Fear was not an issue. I don't know, Jess, what did you think?
Maybe it's because I started drinking coffee again, so I'm a little more nervous.
Walker says she found herself hesitating recently about entering a shopping mall. She knows there are risks to living in a major metropolis.
I feel that there's always something symbolically that people are going to look to attack here. On my way here, I think I smiled at like 15 different people, and I got at least 9 smiles back. I need to connect to people. I need to connect to my neighborhood, and I need to connect to Paris.
Over the years in Paris, both Walker and McClure have gotten used to celebrating Thanksgiving with Americans and other expats, so the festivities tend to take unconventional turns. But after the past 2 weeks, Thanksgiving this year may be just another opportunity to get together with friends and talk things out.
Every day is different since what happened. I mean, I don't think Thanksgiving is going to be different specifically because of the attacks. I mean, it's pretty intense. Every time I see my friends and have a dinner for the last days, that's been the subject of the conversation.
And that conversation, says Walker, has provoked a bit of soul-searching.
This makes me feel more thankful, appreciative for what I've been given in life. It gives you a kick of awareness. And the things that we take for granted a little bit less. And we embrace the things that we sort of love all the more so. You always have the option of looking for a good in anything that happens. And so I'm feeling somber, and I'm feeling good.
I think the strongest emotion that I felt after the attacks was sadness. Somber is a good word as well. I just felt sad.
The attacks have not deterred McClure or Walker's plans to stay in France. On the contrary, Walker says, if anything, they've brought a deepened sense of belonging to the expat community.
There is a feeling that everyone who lives here, whether you have the citizenship or not, after what happened, you do feel French, and you feel that a French part of you was attacked in what happened.
In fact, Walker says she is now getting ready to apply for French citizenship.
Being able to say that I'm a French citizen is actually really important to me. To be able to vote here, I already pay my taxes here, so it's symbolic for me, and I feel like I belong here. I feel connected. Given what happened, I feel all the more so connected. In the people who lost their lives, a part of me was also lost, and a part of France was lost. And so it's actually become really important for me to be able to show sort of France that I stand with it as a country, that I'm not an outsider, to sort of be one, actually. I've never felt that way more so today than before.
For the world, I'm Adeline Sia, Paris.
From Thanksgiving in Paris to Thanksgiving in Fremont, California now. Fremont, it turns out, is home to one of the country's largest Afghan populations. Part of the city is even known as Little Kabul. And for Thanksgiving, one market there offers up turkeys cooked Afghan style. They are halal, of course, certified by Islamic authorities. Reporter Hanna Baba recently stopped in for a taste.
So far, I have about I checked this morning my list, about 67 turkeys for Thanksgiving.
Jamal Siddiqui owns Zamzam Supermarket, a butchery, grocery, bakery, and restaurant. He moved from Afghanistan in 1987 and tested the idea of selling an Afghan-seasoned halal Thanksgiving turkey around 2001.
We started a small sample, but then when people tried, everybody loved it. Now the demand goes higher and higher. We cook the turkey, and our specialty recipe that we use in-house, and it's so delicious.
He shows me one of his freshly cooked turkeys. It's piping hot, orangish red, glowing, and sits on a large stainless steel tray. Instead of smelling like the usual turkey based, its aroma is rich with cumin, ginger, and other spices unfamiliar to my nose. Surrounding the bird are seasoned potatoes, carrots, and zucchini, and inside, not a bread stuffing, but basmati rice.
We cook the rice, and then after that, we kind of toss it with the gravy.
Siddiqui's daughter, Medina, is a young business grad and manages the kitchen with her mom, whose recipe this is. Their gravy is dark red from chilies and blended red bell peppers.
We put the gravy so it has all of the spices and seasonings with it, so the rice is not just plain. And then once it's cooked and it's fully seasoned, we toss in the pine nuts, we mix it together, and then we stuff it inside the turkey.
Seasoned with what, you may ask?
It's more of like Middle Eastern Afghan. So it's the spices that we normally use. There's a little bit of cumin, a little bit of turmeric in it, and then I think that's all I can share before my mom's like, do not share my recipe out.
Okay, fair enough. Now it's tasting time. Jamal pushes tables together and invites every customer who comes through the door to join us.
My name's Elizabeth. Yeah, I just came in to buy onions.
We all sit down to eat, like it's Thanksgiving.
It's not dry. It's not grandma's dry turkey.
Then another customer comes in, Niaz Ahmed. He's here for his daily non-bread run, but he's curious about the turkey.
It looks very good from outside. The taste is in the mouth, you know. Once you taste it, then we'll know. But it looks really delicious.
So he tries it.
Alhamdulillah, this is good, really good stuff. What do you think about it? You've eaten it?
Yeah. I like it. I love it. I love it. There's a little bit of hot spice to it.
Yeah, Louisiana style.
What?
Louisiana style.
Louisiana style. Yeah. Louisiana Afghani style. Yeah.
As more customers join our impromptu Thanksgiving meal, I ask Jamal Siddiqui why this holiday is special for this community.
Unfortunate things that happen in Afghanistan. Now people have started building their life back here. After so many years, this is an appreciation and thank of God to have a good world and good health for us and for our family.
For the world, I'm Hanat Baba, Fremont, California.
When you spend time in another country, it can be life-changing, but it doesn't mean you entirely understand that place. In 1969, Khadija Wanan arrived in the United States as an exchange student. She was a 16-year-old Muslim girl from Morocco heading off to Wisconsin. It's not a place her family knew much about.
My father took a map and he said, show me where you would be going, because he had never heard of Wisconsin before.
She stepped off the airplane to meet the people she would come to call her family. Khadija spent the next year living with the Davis family in the town of Bloomer, population 3,000. The family welcomed her into their home, though the youngest son, Tom, had trouble with her name.
It was very hard for them to say Khadija. And Tom turns to me and says, can I call you Katie? I said, no, I don't mind. And from then on, I was Katie for everybody.
Yeah, that's how it started.
That's Khadija's daughter, Ada Alami. She went to visit the Davis family in Wisconsin earlier this year. We'll hear more about that in a moment.
My mom really loved the year she spent there. She was very active in the school. She joined all kinds of clubs. She was in a play. She was in the art club. Laurie Davis was a year younger than her, so they had the same group of friends. She just fully embraced that American life, and I think it was one of the most important years in her life. I was raised knowing that I had American grandparents and uncles and aunts. My mom, we were in touch with them now and then.
But then things changed suddenly. It happened about 13 years ago.
It all unraveled on the eve of the Iraq War. The Bush administration was preparing to invade Iraq, and my mom was opposed to the war, so she was sending these petitions to all her friends, especially in the U.S., trying to convince them to oppose the war.
I sent a petition to all my friends, saying this war is nonsense, there are no weapons of mass destruction, this is nonsense, and I was asking them to sign the petition. And then I got an email from Laurie telling me, listen, if you are going to send me this kind of things, if you are going to email me this kind of letters, don't talk to me anymore.
I mean, I think my mom really took it personally and was very upset. So she wrote Laurie a long email
saying, I was very proud of myself because the first thing I learned from you guys was tolerance. And I am what I am because you taught me that there's no difference between Arabs and Americans, between Muslim and Christians and things like that. And now I said I'd rather not talk to you anymore because I can't prevent myself from saying what's wrong and what's right. And I started kind of forgetting them.
And that's it. And they stopped talking after that.
And that's how things stood for 11 years, no communication. And then on a trip to the U.S. last year, Ada decided to drive to Bloomer, Wisconsin, to find Laurie Davis and try to understand what had happened. I'll let Ada tell the rest of the story.
I've never been to this part of America. I lived in New York for a long time. I've been to Los Angeles, Las Vegas, Chicago, never to the farm country. I'm really curious to see why my mother loved it so much. She said people here taught her tolerance. So it'd be interesting to find out how people who live in such a small town in the middle of Wisconsin, what's their connection to the world and to Morocco. So we drove to her house, not knowing what to expect, but she welcomed us. And it was extremely emotional because the second she saw me coming out of the car, she was extremely happy. She welcomed me like family.
She looks just like her mother. I would have known right away who she was.
And I wasn't even sure she would want to talk to me, so it was really interesting. And she had a lot of anecdotes to share with me. She didn't mention her fight with my mom, which at a point was a bit strange because I didn't know how to start the conversation. She wasn't mentioning it. And then as we were leaving, she said, I need to explain to you what happened with your mom.
It just was a really scary period of time. And I know, I'm sure, that what Khadijah was talking about was the effect on the women and children, that it was going to cause all these people to be killed. I think that was it, was the humanity part of it. But the thing that was scary for me is, okay, so who is connecting me with this Moroccan woman that is criticizing our government? You know, it was a scary time.
And when I told my mother about Lori's explanation, she was sad to realize that she could have endangered Laurie.
No, but I feel so sorry to hear this. I mean, I could have caused her problems. And just thinking one second that she could have been in trouble because of me, because of a stupid petition.
Oh. I think to my mom, what was a bit shocking was in her mind, the U.S. was this land of freedom where she learned tolerance and to think for herself.
For me, it was a great country because 1 year made me very strong. So I would think that somebody who was born there and grew up there would be even stronger than myself.
Interestingly enough, Lori also speaks about feeling stronger today and being able to stand up against her own government.
If I have a right to my opinion, and just like your mother did, but at the time I was afraid. But the older I'm getting, the more I realize that I have to be accountable for my own self and my thoughts.
So it was sad, but at least we were able to resolve the issue, and I got them on the phone with my mom when I was in Bloomer, and here's a piece of their conversation.
I am very, very good. I'm so glad that Ada was able to track me down so that we could visit.
It makes me feel very, very well talking to you.
Well, we're so glad that we can visit with you. We've had so many wonderful memories that we've been sharing with Ada.
I think we can say that it's a happy ending. I know that my mom is really happy to have them back in her life. I feel like a diplomat. I feel like if I hadn't done this, they maybe would have never spoken to each other again, which would have been very sad.
That's Ada Alami telling the story of her mother's reconnection with her American family in Wisconsin. Ada is a reporter based in Paris. Her story was produced in collaboration with Round Earth Media. Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, Iraqi-Palestinian poet Zina Agha talks about the migrant crisis in Europe and how art can help us cope with tragedy.
If you sideline art, especially in times of crisis, you turn a tragic situation into a completely unsalvageable one because there's no hope left.
The healing power of art, that's ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. There's a drug problem happening in a place that doesn't need any more problems. The place is Syria. The drug is called Captagon. It's known as a superamphetamine. It's being pushed by a violent cartel that spans the Middle East, and the Paris gunmen are believed to have taken it before their attack. Shavala Madlena is a reporter at Foreign Policy who's looked into this superamphetamine.
Captagon is an amphetamine that was invented by A.G. Degussa in the 1960s and the big German pharmaceutical giant. And it was around until about 1984 when the World Health Organization, as well as the FDA, began to look at it and evaluate it as more addictive and harmful than good. It was originally supposed to treat everything from attention deficit disorder. It was used as a dieting aid in some cases. And it was just eventually one of those amphetamines that kind of just fell away.
As an amphetamine, what kind of effect does it give the user that might be different from any other amphetamine?
I've seen everything from it being reported as keeping people calm to making them crazed. It's an amphetamine. It keeps you awake. And then when you stay awake for a long period of time, you are massively susceptible to sleep deprivation psychosis and all the concomitant medical issues that come along with not sleeping and being on a powerful stimulant and psychotropic drug.
You visited an illegal drug factory in Beirut where they're making Captagon. Tell us about that.
It's in one of those kind of like garage / storage units. It's this quite small makeshift area. And all the guys running it look, you know, under 30. They've got tattoos. There's boxes of precursor chemicals, stuff like quinine, caffeine. There's liquids and powder forms of these different chemicals. And when we ask them about what are you actually making here, they call it Captagon, but it's not actually the old form of Captagon that was made by pharmaceutical companies. It's a combination of these things. So it could be different in every batch. And as they were putting it into the pill press, they kind of told us, everybody has their own special recipe. Everybody has their own special flavors they put in. Just like shisha, you have apple shisha, you have mint
the
shisha,
water
you have
pipes, strawberry water shisha. Pipe tobacco.
Exactly.
Turkey just sees 11 million pills of Captagon coming in from Syria. So there's a lot of interest in it in a lot of parts. But who's using it in the Mideast?
Apparently, regular Syrians were using it. It was just one of many drugs that were out there. This is before the war. And you'd see occasionally you'd hear about people using it in Jordan. But mostly it was Saudi Arabia.
Why there?
The explanation that was given to me was that because alcohol is such a taboo and heroin is such a taboo, and they're both not really conducive to being functional, amphetamines are much cheaper and much more appealing and much easier to integrate into your daily life. And there's less stigma around something that was once a prescription pill. Apparently, housewives use it to lose weight. Students use it to study, just like you see with Adderall in America. Truck drivers use it to stay awake, also just like you see with various stimulants all over the world. Mm. And people in the army are apparently a huge market. And we interviewed a former addict who went by the nickname Ahmed. He was a former soldier, and he ended up taking Captagon, which ended up for him being a gateway drug into other things. But he said it was rife in his community, which is a kind of lower socioeconomic, less educated, lots of guys working in the army or in law enforcement.
There are reports from French media that there's increasing evidence that the Paris attackers had been in possession of Captagon and may have even been high on it during the attacks. Would that surprise you? And why would they take it prior to an attack?
It doesn't surprise me. From speaking with former Syrian fighters, this pill is rife on the battlefield there. And areas where we know that former criminal syndicates had factories and supply lines smuggling pills out before the war and during the war are now controlled by ISIS. It's hard to imagine that this drug that's so prevalent on the battlefield in Syria and in places where ISIS now controls it is not being used by, you know, hundreds and hundreds of fighters. It's cheap. It's readily available. It doesn't surprise me.
Filmmaker and journalist Shavala Madlena, her article, Serious Speed Freaks, Jihad Junkies, and Captagon Cartels, is at foreignpolicy.com. Shavala, thank you very much.
Thanks.
It's hard to say who exactly is high on Captagon, but one thing is certain. For Syrians surrounded by fighters, it's got to be even more frightening that some of them may be jumpy, agitated, and have a hair trigger because they're on the drug. It just makes fleeing Syria all the more tempting. And even as I speak, the flow of people has not stopped. Of course, many of those who have left have lost their lives on the way to Europe. That's what happened to a family member of my next guest, Zina Aga. Zina is an Iraqi-Palestinian poet who has family in Syria. She told me what happened to her cousin.
My auntie, my father's sister, lives in Damascus, and she had 10 children. And very beautiful family, very warm and loving. Out of her 10 children, one was taken prisoner. We don't know what's happened there. And the other one, who is a 26-year-old engineer, wanted a better life in Fortress Europe and got on a migrant dinghy, paid one of the smugglers about £1,000 to go from Turkey to Greece. Now, we don't know exactly what happened, but we believe that by the time that he got to Greece, the Greek authorities turned them away. And it was on the return back to Turkey that the dinghy capsized and they drowned.
What went through your mind when you heard that news, especially given all the other thousands of people who've lost their lives in the Mediterranean?
I found out a year ago, and honestly, the thing I felt immediately was irony, because 2 weeks before, I'd gone to Granada, to Spain, off just for a weekend, and I actually wrote a Facebook status being like, took a photo of my British passport and wrote, this is the passport that lets me go wherever I want, and people are dying in boats. And then 2 weeks later, I'd found out that around 2 weeks before, my cousin had actually been one of them. So inadvertently, I'd sort of stumbled into this narrative without even being part of it. And my father was very deadpan in his delivery and quite resigned to it. But I think for me, especially kind of with that young optimism that I think so many early teens have when they look at this crisis, I was just sort of filled with this crippling sense of injustice. And it sounds bizarre, but guilt, the idea of like, there literally is no difference between us and this is how I'm living. These basic things I take for granted, my people are suffering from not having them.
Yeah, that sense of survivor's guilt almost.
Yeah, in many ways.
Like I said, Zina is a poet, and I'd like you to hear a part of a poem she wrote after the death of her cousin. It's called The Sea is Big.
I have nothing to add. It is all said. Of bodies and shores and salted tears in the salted seas
and memorials in dinghies capsized, and memories in homes blasted, bombed, and ransacked. A deficit of humanity. Facing trouble at home displaced and disgraced, facing borders not of our own misplaced and mistakes, no choice but to flee.
I asked Zina how poetry has helped her get through that personal tragedy and the larger one at hand.
Poetry's been a lifeline. I think everyone needs a form of expression for these sorts of events, otherwise they go mad, whether or not they have a relationship to the region. It's a form of self-brutalization to constantly see these images on your TV and then switch it on and carry on with your life. And for me, my form of expression comes with poetry. I kind of fell into poetry. I didn't ever intend on doing it, and I don't really intend on spending my life doing it. It's just something I really enjoy doing and something I actually need to articulate my confusion. It's resonated with people, thankfully, and I think that's just because we all are kind of looking for some artistic understanding of what is going on that isn't just, you know, the sensationalism of the TV or the dryness of the political speeches in the UN or wherever else.
I mean, it's interesting because last week at Harvard, I heard you read The Sea is Big, and it struck me that a poem about the loss of a loved one, you know, brings home the crisis at a personal level, but it feels kind of powerless, too, in the face of this grinding war. On the other hand, hearing a poem talking about this tragedy was something I had not heard, really, yet. So I'm just wondering how art in general does help in these nightmarish moments.
Enormously, at least for me. I mean, I don't want to speak for anyone else, but enormously, because I think we, like I said, we spend so much time just internalizing all of this trauma on the TV as viewers, as consumers of this news. And actually what art does, it brings you into the debate. It engages your heart, not just your head, and hopefully by extension your hands as well, so you actually start making a difference. And I also think, you know, in our nature, if I can be so bold to say such a thing as human nature, we find ourselves inextricably leaning towards creativity. And, you know, it's why we like music and film and theatre and all those things just to entertain us. And it's a double-edged sword because it can entertain us, but it can also open our eyes to things that media or, you know, newspapers alone just can't articulate. It has a kind of tenderness to it that very few things do. And I think if you sideline art, especially in times of crisis, you turn a tragic situation into a completely unsalvageable one because there's no hope left.
Iraqi-Palestinian poet Zina Agha. By the way, at PRI.org, we've got video of Zina reading her poem, The Sea is Big. When was the first time you heard a radio? Hard to say, isn't it? I have a recollection of seeing the glowing tubes in the back of my dad's old radio. Most of us probably heard a radio before we can even remember. Not Pat Herbert, though. He grew up in a very rural part of County Mayo in Ireland. No electricity, no luxuries. In 1947, just after World War II, Herbert was 10 years old, and he still hadn't heard a radio. Then it happened. Herbert told his story to producer Reggie Howd. And one additional note, it has to do with the game of Gaelic football, the national sport of Ireland.
Everywhere was in darkness. We didn't have any electricity. Very little candles, even. It was after the war, and oil was rationed. If you could get the oil, you mightn't have the money to buy it. And the All-Ireland football final was being played outside of Ireland for the first and only time. And this was the occasion. I didn't realise it at the time. And it was played in the polo grounds in New York and being broadcast into Ireland. There we were, out in the middle of nowhere. And all of a sudden, word spread to the adjoining villages that neighbours of ours had acquired what was called a wireless.
I look down on this scene of splendor, the crowd and team do honor to the national anthem.
The house was a little cottage and it was full of adults. I can tell you there was not any room for any more.
falls to the ground. He passes it out to Dan Kavanagh.
The place was full outside and inside. We as children had to stay out in the front garden. It was about 9 or 10 o'clock at night in September, and of course, pitch darkness everywhere. Except for this little radio in the corner on the windowsill. And it lit up the valves, the bulbs in the radio, lit up the place with artificial light, with batteries. It was the first time I saw artificial light, and it lit up the kitchen of the house. Everywhere else was in darkness, right around, everywhere, countryside, all in darkness. You can imagine a youngster, everybody was scared of the dark. And all of a sudden you saw this artificial lighting. I always believed it was when I first saw the light. Little magic eye. Yeah, magic eye. We call it magic eye, it's a green eye. I couldn't visualise this, how this could come all the way from New York into a cottage in the west of Ireland, over a few thousand miles, and no wires. And I was mystified, and I think it damaged my brain, and that's why I'm talking to you here now.
Do you think it damaged you?
Oh, definitely. Oh, absolutely.
How?
I'm surrounded with all these damn things. Hundreds of them. Hundreds of them.
What must have been his feelings at this supreme moment?
Is the light burning yet?
Yep. Clear and bright, thank heaven.
The tremendous expanse of ocean had been bridged. Continents would speak with each other of their several aspirations. A ship in distress in the perilous wastes of the seas could be succored. Lovers separated by a hemisphere would confer privily and be comforted. Empire builders isolated in desert and jungle would hear the sounds of their cities and be cheered and refreshed. A new world would be born.
And that's how it all began for me, you know. You heard of Hertz. In the 1880s, he discovered those waves in the atmosphere. They're called after him, Hertzian waves. They're called the radio waves now. They've been there from the beginning of time, but nobody knew. Now, that's where it all began. I don't know where it's going to end. There's a great big universe out there. We really don't know so little about it, the future, you know. But that's the past.
Yeah, but so exciting. 78-year-old Pat Herbert told his story to producer Reggie Howd. He's now surrounded by lights and radio dials at his hurdy-gurdy museum of vintage radio near Dublin. You can see Herbert's story told through animation in a special U.S. premiere video at PRI.org. This is The World. It rained on the Pope's parade today, literally, but it did not seem to dampen spirits in Kenya. A Kenyan choir helping Pope Francis celebrate his first public mass in Africa there. 300,000 people crowded onto the campus of the University of Nairobi despite heavy downpours. My BBC colleague Anne Soy is following the Pope's visit to Africa.
People have been anticipating this visit for a long time, and finally it is here. In spite of the rainfall, many people turned up at the celebration of the Mass that was at the University of Nairobi grounds. Some of them were there from midnight local time, waiting for hours for the Mass to start. And the government declared today a day of prayer so that people need to go to work, and that helped ease traffic in Nairobi.
Pope Francis is known as the people's pope. How populous did he get? Did he get wet and muddy like a lot of the crowd?
Well, I do not think he got wet and muddy. He had huge dais that was built just for the mass. And, of course, the red carpet everywhere, even where he was planting a tree, the United Nations headquarters. It has been a very interesting visit, especially for the people here. The fact that he chose a small car to take him from the airport, that has really given him a lot of admirers here. People liking his simple lifestyle, his humility.
Kenya has suffered from religious extremism, not too unlike what Paris has gone through and Bamako last week. Did the Pope address the issue of dialogue between different faiths?
Yes, this has been a major theme of his message, and he actually held a meeting with religious leaders from different faiths. There were Muslims, Sikhs, Hindus, as well as African traditional religious leaders, and he emphasized the need for all these leaders to work together to deal with the issue of youth who are radicalized, to kill in the name of God, he said. He said that no one should be allowed to promote hatred in the name of God. The fact that they have met with the Pope this morning has re-emphasized the importance of them being at the forefront in fostering peace and dealing with extremism.
Kenya has also seen in recent years an evolution on the environmental front. And I know the Pope was pretty tough on the environment and policy and urging people heading to climate talks in Paris to get serious.
That's right. His toughest message yet has been on environment, saying that, you know, it's for the common good of everyone. First of all, the Pope was very categorical that climate change is a major issue. He says it's one of the biggest challenges that is facing humanity at the moment. And he called on the people who will be discussing the issues of environment in Paris to be sensitive to the needs of everyone rather than looking at partisan interests that promote projects and plans of just a few people.
There was something that caught my eye, too. I gather the Pope was speaking with some seminarians in Kenya and told them not to waste their time watching TV. What was that about?
He was speaking off the cuff when he met the priests and the nuns. And the Pope himself says that he made a promise not to watch TV. Since 1990, we understand he has never watched television. So it's very interesting, this message that he gave to them.
I mean, so many issues to tackle for one person on this continent: corruption, poverty, environment, religious extremism. Do you think Kenyans, anyway, see the Pope as a force for change?
Yes. People are generally very receptive to the message of the Pope, and they're hoping that we've been seeing the messages on social media, people saying that they're hoping their leaders are listening and watching the Pope.
My BBC colleague Anne Soy joining me from Nairobi. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you want to celebrate Thanksgiving in Kenya, good luck finding all the dishes for a classic dinner. Maintaining this American tradition abroad often comes with culinary challenges. So we end this holiday edition of The World with the story of one especially challenging Thanksgiving abroad from reporter Sarah Birnbaum in Cape Town, South Africa.
If they don't have a turkey, I'd be really sad. Oh, here we are. And they have it.
Marissa Kaplan is doing some last-minute Thanksgiving shopping at the local grocery store. The Pennsylvania native has been hosting the holiday here in South Africa for the past 9 years, and she says she's learned some valuable lessons, especially from her experience last year.
A friend of mine, she is Zimbabwean, and she lives in a really big house in Johannesburg, and we decided we were going to throw a Thanksgiving. It was very international, people kind of from all over, South Africans, but also people from Europe and from the U.S.
They were expecting 50 people in all. Now, Marissa was living in Cape Town, about a two-hour flight to Johannesburg. So she plans to arrive the day of, have the groceries delivered to Lungi's house, and then begin cooking.
But I failed to remember the fact that in South Africa, you don't buy fresh turkeys. You can only buy frozen turkeys. And so I think it was maybe a couple days before I was about to fly up, I ordered the groceries online, and I realized that by the time that they would be delivered, there wouldn't be enough time for the turkey to defrost.
So what to do? Well, buy a turkey in Cape Town, begin the defrost, and then put the thawing bird in the overhead compartment on your flight to Johannesburg. But Marissa doesn't just buy a turkey. She also buys that symbol of American excess, a turducken, a chicken stuffed into a duck, stuffed into a turkey.
I had to take my turkey and my turducken through, you know, the check. So I felt quite uncomfortable, and people did give me funny looks. I got a couple of people asking, you know, what's in there? Are you like a heart transplant surgeon?
So the flight lands, she gets to Lungi's house, and something very South African happens.
I'm marinating the turducken, and all of a sudden all the lights go out.
It's not like in the U.S. where the power only goes out if there's a big storm. In South Africa, there's not enough supply of electricity. It's a big issue for people here. The power company deals with this by shutting off the electricity to certain neighborhoods to ease the load on the system. It's called load shedding, basically a scheduled rolling blackout.
So there was going to be no electricity from 2 o'clock in the afternoon until 6. And our guests were coming probably, you know, at 6 or 7 o'clock.
Remember, 50 guests are coming. So Marissa and a friend of hers pop into the car, the turkey in the front seat, the turducken in the back, and drive around Johannesburg trying to think of someone, anyone, who has power. Then inspiration strikes. Marissa remembers this friend of a friend of a friend, Mike.
And Mike is the bachelor. So I guess two things that are important to note. One is that he had never used his oven. So when we got there, it was like, I don't know, still encased in plastic. And he had just started dating a new girl, and it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and they were still in bed.
Marissa charges in, greets the confused girlfriend, rips the plastic shrink wrap from the oven, crams in both her turkey and her turducken, and miraculously makes it back in time for Thanksgiving.
We had a lot to be thankful for, yes. It was really a wonderful Thanksgiving.
For The World, Sarah Birnbaum, Cape Town, South Africa.
We here at The World are thankful to have listeners like you. So thank you for being here today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Enjoy the rest of your day.
PRI, Public Radio International.